a young man named Barack Obama. Subsequent to that meeting, he joined the White House on the staff in 2009 as special counsel to the president. He was nominated and later served to become the United States Ambassador to Australia, where I met him. Welcome to Pacific Conversation, Jeff Blush. Well, welcome, Ambassador Blush. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Professor Blakely.
Little official, but yeah. We were both in those roles.
That's right.
And Australia is at the University of Sydney and the U.S. Studies Center, where we had some opportunity to do some good things, I think.
Yeah, no, very important work and great research there.
Yeah.
And I've been affiliated with the U.S. Studies Center as well, and really admire what you've done there.
Yeah. So now I want to talk about how in the world does a guy from Oakland become ambassador to Australia as a fellow Aucklander?
Yeah, no, completely dumb luck. I'm like the Forrest Gump of diplomacy, I think. I stumbled into the right room at the right time. A number of years ago, I met a young law student who my judge wanted to recruit, named Barack Obama, and the judge actually asked me to see if I could convince him to clerk. And so I called him up, and afterward, I remember telling the judge, who was, you know, well-regarded judge and fed a lot of people to the U.S. Supreme Court, that this guy, the good news was the most interesting guy I've ever talked to, fabulous, but he doesn't want a clerk, so that's the bad news. So the judge grabbed his resume, went into his office, said, I'm going to call him. Calls Obama and comes back to my office, still holding the resume. He points to him and he goes, now this is the kind of guy I ought to be hiring. I'm like, you mean instead of me? And he goes, yeah, exactly. Call him again. Call this guy again. Yeah, so I called then, you know, Barack Obama, and we developed a friendship. I never recruited him, but he got very good at recruiting me. And I worked with him as special counsel in the White House. I worked with him on a number of issues. And when we started to focus on the rebalance to the Asia Pacific, and he was looking for someone who he knew well and who he knew was very interested in Australia and the region, he asked me if I'd be willing to take the posting. And, you know, it was a job of a lifetime, really wonderful.
So we've gone right into it. You come to Australia. When you got here, the U.S. Studies Center had been around about 4 years, but suspicion among Australians toward the United States was still pretty high.
Oh, yeah, not dramatically.
How did you find Australia when you got here, and what did you feel you had to overcome?
Well, you know, I found Australia extraordinarily welcoming, and it reminded me of what I like to think of as, you know, America at our very best. Optimistic, welcoming, take our work seriously, but don't take ourselves too seriously, and really committed to doing good in the world. And I think, you know, I felt that kinship from the beginning. But as you said, we had just come out of the global financial crisis, as well as failing war in Iraq, which was, you know, misconceived. And I think there was a general sense among particularly younger Australians that although the United States may have been a wonderful champion and ally for their parents, their sense of our economic leadership was a financial crisis, and their sense of our security leadership was the Iraq war, which many of them opposed. And so based upon that, I felt I had a lot of work to do to sort of rebuild the sense of confidence and trust that had been the hallmark of this relationship for a new generation, and to reinforce it as well among others who had been longtime fans of the U.S., but were starting to doubt our focus.
How did you start that? What were some things you did? I did a few of them with you, but give me an idea of the range.
Well, a few of the things were just being direct and honest about what had happened and where we were and what we were trying to accomplish in the world. You know, people's memories tend to be short and they only remember the last few years. So trying to put what the U.S. and Australia Alliance had accomplished in context, I think helps. But also just being willing to acknowledge mistakes. So I did some things that other ambassadors, I think, either would have been reluctant to do or, you know, didn't have enough courage by their public affairs group to let them do. But I, you know, I went on Q&A, which is for a diplomat, a pretty frightening system, because diplomats can only say very little and you can't get away with that. You go on a stage, it's a live show. You can be asked questions by anyone on the panel, by the moderator, all very great people. From people in the audience, you could even have, you know, a video pop up and someone who is virulently anti-American could ask whatever question they want. So, but I felt very confident with President Obama's leadership. And I also felt confident that if you're saying things that you truly believe and you're willing to level with people, they may not always agree with you, but they'll appreciate the candor and they'll appreciate the fact that you're genuine.
One of the things that you did, you traveled the country extensively, talking to business people and others. Few ambassadors have done that before or since.
No, that's nice to recognize. That was also a big part of it, which is rather than telling people how things ought to be, it's much better to sort of learn how they are and then work together on, you know, our combined aspirations. So I really wanted to get to know Australia in a much deeper way than I had before. I'd been to Australia before. I'd loved Australia, but I hadn't been to, you know, every part of it. And so I think the best measure of that approach was as I was leaving, they have this ceremony where they, you know, listed all the, you know, all the events we'd attended and hosted and all the treaties we'd signed and all the blogs I'd posted and, you know, sort of all these statistics. But the one that stood out in my mind, which was that of the 198 weeks or 100, you know, is that right? Yeah, 198 weeks that I had been in Australia, the total number where I had spent the entire week in Canberra was 2.
And I can believe it. You popped up all over the place. As a matter of fact, your name's still here on a program with South Australia, University of South Australia, right?
Flinders University.
Flinders University in South Australia.
Yeah, there's the Jeff Bleich Center on the U.S. Alliance Studies in Digital Technology, Security, and Governance, which has really been my focus.
And that's where I want to go now. Focus when you were here. Digital technology. What were some of the other focuses you had in the region and in the nation?
Well, you know, as I said, part of my focus had been that the Asia Pacific, I think, had been a little bit underweight in terms of U.S. commitment there. Mm-hmm. Now we were present, but it had become the most dynamic, most productive, one of the fastest growing economically, but also, you know, one of the more complicated regions in the world. It really felt like the United States needed to be there. So the rebalance was a principal part of the focus. And that had both, you know, economic and it had diplomatic and it had, you know, national security elements to it. So
talk about the Chinese and where were they at the time? You know, South China Sea is a big deal now. Yeah. What was it back in your day? Those kind of issues with China and kind of the big dogs in the Pacific, Japan, et cetera. Who were the people you were focused on?
Yeah, no, that was actually a very it's a very interesting time. I was fortunate to be there during a period of real transition President Hu was very different from President Xi. During the Hu leadership, we had a sense that there were multiple paths that China was contemplating. One was more hegemonic in nature, which was they weren't going to invade other countries, but they did want to have the dominance over the region through economic and other means. But there were also, voices that said, just allow China to continue to rise, stay relatively self-contained. And there are others that said, if we continue the rise that we have, we can't limit ourselves to asserting power in the region. We really need to become responsible state actors for the whole world, because there are only a handful of superpowers. And if they rose to that level, they would need to do a lot of the things that the United States had done in terms of trying to maintain peace and stability around the world. Because, when you're sort of the top dogs, it's not only your responsibility, but it's to your advantage to have a stable world that isn't dislocating an order which is, keeping you strong.
Did you find them partners because it's tense now?
Yeah, and that was it. There was this period of time where I thought there was, different paths, and we were trying to shape, influence, nudge. And some of the things that were part of this rebalance were designed to accomplish that. So really three things: the diplomatic things. We signed the Treaty of Cooperation and Amity to become part of ASEAN. We joined the East Asia Summit and made it a principles level summit where the president himself would attend. We developed the Indian Ocean Rim Initiative that sort of connected, South Asia as well. So we did a number of diplomatic moves, including really reinvigorating APEC, so that there was a cohesive, comprehensive set of diplomatic organizations that would cover any kind of issue, whether it was a security issue or an economic issue, that had all the major powers at the table. And I think, that was a significant set of moves. The second set of moves were really tying our allies and partners in the region together better in terms of our security posture. And so we did a lot of training exercises and really reached out to countries that we hadn't worked with before with that level of intensity. We started a trilateral dialogue with Japan, the U.S., Australia, and Japan. And the notion behind that, candidly, was that we have such a good relationship with Australia. We work so well with Australia. We thought that other partners and allies would benefit from just witnessing what a kind of seamless and trusting relationship can accomplish. We found it was very helpful to do these trilaterals, and other countries would actually, strengthen our bilateral relationship, having seen how well we worked with Australia. And we did some additional things, in particular, rotational training of Marines in Northern Australia, and some airfield disbursement, which I think also gave us a stronger posture in the region, a greater sense of our commitment. And then the last thing we focused on was economically, how we could become more integrated. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership was really an effort that we championed with Australia to pull together a large block of similarly interested countries to not necessarily create a counterweight to China, but to create a trading block that was so significant that China would want to be part of it and would look for a rules-based order that would give it the opportunity to participate.
That's and interesting. Those
were, yeah.
Because so
that was the plan, and that's how we hoped to shape the relationship with China at that time.
Yeah, but Boy, that's foreign language now.
Yeah, well, a number of things happened. With the rise of President Xi, we saw a more nationalistic approach and a trend, not necessarily a full-on commitment at that point, but a trend towards some of the things that we had been concerned about, a more hegemonic approach. And I think there had been a very effective summit between President Obama and President Xi in the last couple of years of the Obama administration, Sunnylands in Southern California, where the president essentially said, "We know what you're doing, and we have a lot of powers to make you knock it off. It's not in your interest to do this to us, and it's not in our interest either for us to not be partners." But there was I think there was a real sense of American resolve and American recognition of China's change in approach and ambitions. And there had been a number of things they did, the dust up with Senkaku Islands and the cutting off of rare earths. And there had been, some maneuvers in the South China Sea, cutting, telecommunications cables and threatening Vietnamese fishing boats. I mean, all those were adding up, as well as a real, just a free-for-all in cyberspace. So based on that, I think we had positioned ourselves well for a new and more productive relationship with China, where, there was mutual, respect, but recognition that America was not going to be trifled with, and that our allies were just an extraordinary bulwark against over-aggressive ambitions. This changed pretty dramatically, I think, with the election of President Trump.
Yes, it certainly has. First of all, there was an ambassador for, 2 years?
What's that? Oh, yeah, no, so there...
There was no ambassador. It was really a floating crap game. Even here in Sydney, we had no relationship anymore with the consulate, like the old days.
Yeah.
There was belligerence, real belligerence, mm-hmm. toward China, and almost getting Australia to act the same ways. And that some of that is still here. We need to work that through. I think, this is my view, that punching China in the nose is not the way to get to the future.
Well, and also, if you're going to punch someone, bunge them where it matters.
Yeah.
And
hurt them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, what troubled me, there were a few things. I'll tell you, because I'm not here to, bash the Trump administration, but there were some moves initially. And I was in Beijing right after the election and, was able to really gauge the Chinese reaction. But one thing that President Trump did, for example, is, he unilaterally unsigned the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
Now, even if that was good politics in the United States, and even if, you just say, well, politics matters and you need to do it for that reason, he didn't need to do it right away, and he didn't need to do it without seeking any concessions or without repairing some damage with allies. So if he really wanted to maximize that move, what he should have said is, look, China has been abusing a lot of trade rules. The thing they're most afraid of is this Trans-Pacific Partnership. All you do is tell China, look, I said that on the campaign trail, but unless you give me the following things, there's no way I'm going to unsign that. We've got you. And he would have gotten major concessions from China. We never would have had to have a trade war. But instead, the person who wrote the art of the deal just gave it away for nothing. And in the meantime, really, lost the confidence of, the 12 other nations or the 11 other nations who were parties to the TPP, who we had encouraged and really put a lot of energy into convincing to join the TPP. So we undermine our alliances, which were so critical, We gave up what was a very valuable deal, and we asked for absolutely nothing in return from China for it. That's something that China recognized, and they said, you know, we know statecraft. This guy may be good at real estate in New York, but he does not know statecraft.
And, well, we have a dangerous situation now here in Australia, because it feels like the partnership isn't what was when you were here. And my perception, and I've been here over 20 years, this was always a two-team match. When we went to China, we didn't forget Australia and vice versa. Yeah. Now, here we are in Australia trying to punch way above our weight without a partner. How do we get the partnership back and working together? Because it's got to be a Trans-Pacific partnership, not Australia alone.
I think that's, you know, look, Australia is extraordinarily capable and it defines its own interests, but it also understands that given just its, well, you know, the nice thing about the US-Australia relationship is that the fundamentals of the relationship haven't changed. You know, we still share common values. We still have a common sense of purpose. I think we have long and deep relations that are not just strategic. They're not just, transactional. You know, we genuinely like each other. And I think you can see that just in the way, you know, Australians and Americans get along. One of Australia's strengths in the region has been its ability to get along with lots of countries. And it was always something that the United States encouraged, because there were some times when Australians and Americans agreed on a policy, but if it's said by an American, it's seen as bullying, and if it's said with an Australian accent, then it's perfectly sensible. we really, you know, enjoyed the fact that Australians were not only our friends, but friends throughout the region. And likewise, I think the U.S. was a great convening power that brought a number of these relationships together towards a common purpose. And so it was very advantageous to Australia to have that American influence in the region. And when we worked together, it wasn't, as I said, just transactional. We really enjoyed it, and we were accomplishing things that we both thought were positive for the world. That hasn't gone away. The capacity to do that hasn't gone away. I think one of the challenges for the United States and Australia is going to be to repair some damage, you know, some bruised feelings, some loss of perspective. Mm-hmm. That can happen in the heat of the last 4 years, which were very tumultuous years. But I think there's also a lot of work to be done with our partners in the region. And probably the best thing that we could do is, instead of worrying too much about, talking through our feelings, mm-hmm. It's to get out there and do the work together with other countries and bring them on board. I think Australians and Americans, we tend to do better when we're busy doing a project together than when we're just trying to talk. And so I think working with other countries would be the next and most important first step.
Yeah, I just see too much bilateral stuff going on from my point of view. We've got Korea and Japan and Indonesia and all of us talking the same language, walking the same walk, and behaving like we have a partnership.
Yeah, look, I thought one of the great moves of the Biden administration in terms of its foreign policy already is, you know, within its first 75 days in office, when, you know, they still don't even have all the lights on in the White House and lots of posts are still unfilled. One of the first things they did was this quadrilateral meeting mm-hmm. with the U.S., Australia, Japan, and India. I think that was a real, you know, demonstration of commitment to the region and a desire to engage India even more deeply in these areas of common interest for Western democracies or any form of democracy.
Right.
It's, you know, that's really been the challenge, is that democracies sort of forget that with these new technologies, we are much more vulnerable. Whatever differences we may have, we're bound by a vulnerability to misuse of these technologies that threatens the very principle of self-determination and self-governance.
Yeah, so putting it all back together, there are a couple things that concern me. One, the talent pool. I was in state, as you probably know. State is a place where you develop talent deliberately. Mm-hmm. And we lost a lot of that talent in just 4 years. The second is this anti-Asian thing in the United States is creeping to Australia. You know, I never thought that could happen here in Australia. Didn't even occur to me. Now, some of this is the pandemic, but it's ugly. How do we get back to the president's doing a great job? I think Joe's doing a great job. But we still don't have a culture that is doing a great job. How do we get that culture back, Jeff? Do you and I have to go on the road again?
Those are three tough questions. I think first, you know, the Foreign Service was not as hollowed out as I think people worried. A lot of folks just hung in there. Had President Trump been reelected, I think a lot of people would have left the Foreign Service, but there were quite a few who didn't agree with his approach to foreign relations, but felt it was their duty, their responsibility to hang in there. And I saw that also in the intelligence services and other groups that focus very, very much on foreign policy. And so there was damage done. I'm not suggesting there wasn't, but it's reparable. I think the anti-Asian rhetoric and how it has infected public discourse and led to these horrific attacks on Asian Pacific Islanders in the U.S. and other places around the world,
even here in Australia.
It's disgraceful, and it's not who we are. And I think the fact that the President of the United States has come out so strongly against it. I mean, after the shootings in Atlanta, you know, he immediately lowered the flag to half staff in over the White House. This is a statement by the president that this is not who we are, and that he's going to make this a priority. You know, again, I'm a great lover of technology, and I work in the technology industry. But I also understand that any tool can do good and it can do harm, depending on who wields it and for what purpose. So technology in the wrong hands, you know, just like a hammer, you know, can build a house or break a skull. Technology can either solve a problem or it can create a new and massive one. And I think our culture has suffered to some extent because of the way we've used technology. It's become coarser. It's become more isolated in interesting ways and combative. And I think as a result, people have started to become a little tribal online, and they look for the information that reinforces their biases. They don't know what information to trust. They don't, you know what's a reliable source of knowledge. And as a result, it's made it very difficult for us to speak civilly to each other and to find areas for compromise and common good. And that, I think, is one of the big challenges for us. If we're going to repair our culture and repair our democracies, it's going to begin to some extent with getting a better handle on how we communicate through these new means, these new technologies, so that we can trust facts again. Because without facts, we just don't have a common language.
Yeah, that's why I try to move beyond the news and talk to people like you. And I'm trying to get this, it's called the Dialogue Across the Pacific. We have to start talking together and trusting one another and getting the information from the horse's mouth. Thus, I'm talking to you, Kim Beasley, Carr, and many others who have been there and walked the walk. We cannot hope to dispel all these rumors unless we have people who speak the truth.
Yeah, well, you know, when you interview, you know, Ambassador Beasley, now Governor Beasley, or, you know, former Foreign Minister Carr, or former Senator Carr, one of the things that stands out about both of them is that they were both and are both great students of history.
Yes.
And I try and keep up with history. And the reason is it's very hard to contextualize events today unless you can see how they resemble things that happened in the past and what we did in the past and how we came out of similar difficult situations, how we unstuck ourselves. The kind of technological revolution that we're experiencing now is, you know, in many ways almost identical to one we had 100 years ago. And a lot of the same things happened in terms of a rise of xenophobia and anti-immigrant violence. There was a great balkanization of wealth between the very wealthy and everyone else. There was the development of yellow journalism and a weakening of critical institutions, whether it was corruption in government or a lack of confidence in stories coming through the media. And there were, we had to fundamentally change our education system. There are all these things that happened during that time that we're experiencing now. And they made it through, haltingly difficult, as it was. They made it through and the U.S. and Australia emerged as two of the greatest countries in the world out of that period. We're going through one of those periods again. And looking back through history, it gives you a sense of optimism because you know it can be done. It also gives you a perspective on what you shouldn't do and mistakes we shouldn't repeat and a few pathways.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation. And this conversation is an illustration of what you just talked about. I'm trying to use the device we have right now, a piece of technology, to spread the truth.
Yes.
And each of us tries to do the same thing, we'll have a truer, better, more just society. You can't give it up because you pass your 80th birthday, it doesn't mean you're dead. And if Joe's going to go, I'm going to go too. He's stepping, he's moving. And I hope to be with you again in some forums so we can speak the truth and make the United States, help the United States become what it needs to be.
Yeah, well, I love the idea of seeing you again in person without any masks on and being able to share a good glass of Australian wine together. I also love the idea of the fact that people of all ages and all perspectives using our technology for good to share truth and to help repair the things that have broken and to build upon the things that have always remained strong between our countries. So
in conversations doing that. Yeah, in conversations like that in classrooms, I'm hoping some of our work, what our conversation is, a great conversation for follow-up in a class in civics.
Oh, well, anytime, you name the place, I'm there for you.
Oh, thank you, mate. It's been really terrific. And next time in Oakland.
Yes, inshallah.
Inshallah. Ciao.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
More Pacific Conversations coming out every fortnight. Subscribe wherever you find the podcast to make sure you don't miss out. And for more, check out edtalks.com.au. And for weekly US news and current affairs, check out Ed's other podcast, US of Ed, with myself, Sean Britton. Available wherever you find good podcasts, as well as on Facebook and Twitter.